Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Allie on the Run show. I'm your host, Allie Feller, and today you have made it to episode 37. Today, I'm super excited to welcome my friend Lindsay Hine to the Allie on the Run show. Lindsay is a speedy runner, a mom of three boys, Marshall, my main man, Lewis, and Russell, and she's the host of I'll Have Another with Lindsay Hine. I was a guest on Lindsay's podcast back in November. We recorded together just a few days before she was due with her youngest son, Russell, and it was my first foray into podcasting. I loved it so much that it gave me the push to finally go ahead and launch my own show. And here we are today, 37 episodes in and flipping the script by getting Lindsay on the other side of the conversation. I love listening to her talk with her guests on her show, but I wanted to bring Lindsay here to get more of her story, and it's a really good one. This episode gets into everything from the super personal, like Lindsay's decision to have a preventative double mastectomy and her two miscarriages, to the lighter stuff like running, coaching, surviving life with three kids and a dog, and how she met her sassy husband, Glenn. No further intro needed. Let's put Lindsay in the hot seat. All right, so Lindsay Hine, welcome to the Allie on the Run show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited because we're flipping the script. Normally, you get to be in the seat I'm in right now, but I want to know about your story today. So start us off. We start with a warm-up on the Allie on the Run show. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and what it is that you do.
Okay, well, first of all, I just have to say I'm really excited to not be the one interviewing right now. I didn't have to prep for this. I went to the pool and swam this morning, and then I laid out by the pool and read a book, and I was like, I have a podcast at two, but I'm the one that gets to answer the question, so I don't have to like think of anything to say, you know?
Yay!
To ask. But so I'm Lindsay, and I live in Indianapolis, Indiana, with my husband, Glenn, and we have three boys, Marshall, Lewis, and Russell. And our doggy, I have to mention our dog, Cadence, because I know Allie is such a dog lover.
Yes, big time. I know. So where did the name Cadence come from?
Dude, I don't even know. Well, we were thinking like Cadence as in you ride your bike and you have cadence on your bike. And we thought that was cool because we were athletic and we like to ride bikes and run and all that. So we were like, oh, that's like a cool athletic name. But now people are naming their kids Cadence. So it's funny when someone tells me that their kid's name is Cadence, I always almost say, oh, that's my dog's name. But then I'm like, no, Lindsay, stop. That's awesome.
I will say, so I've always had this name in mind for if I have a daughter someday. If I have a boy someday, I have no idea. I'll just give him the name that I have in mind for the girl, I guess, even though it's not a boy name. But it is kind of a common dog name. And it's fine. It's fine. Cadence, I like Cadence for a dog, but I like that for a kid too. It's a girl name, right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, you have Ellie, and Ellie's a totally a kid's name.
Well, so I will say, Ellie, I had like two names that I liked for if I had a daughter someday, but I was like, I don't know when that's going to be, but I know I'm getting a dog, and Ellie was one of the two names, so.
Oh, your dog stole your kid name.
Yeah.
You know what? I always say this. I think my kids, maybe not Marshall as much, but I think Lewis is such a solid dog name. And that's my second kid. I just love that name so much for a dog. So if anybody out there wants to name their dog Lewis, I think it's cool.
All for it. Well, it's funny we're having this conversation now because the last time we talked, when I was on your podcast back in November, but we recorded it right before you had Russell, and we talked about baby names, and I tried to convince you to name him Allie, and you didn't, which is pretty rude. So
that's right. I know. Well, I was super pregnant when we recorded that.
I know. I was afraid you were going to go into labor.
Yes. For sure.
Right,
and now he's 8 months old.
I know.
Which is crazy.
And I mean, has the best hair of any child I've ever seen. I know it's not a competition, but it should be because, I mean, Russell just hands down best hair.
And I already cut his mullet. He had a mullet and I cut it. So I left the like suave hair on top that kind of brushes over. So.
All right. Well, let's talk about your kids because I am so impressed. You have three boys between the ages of 8 months and five. So tell me about, I hate the question, how do you do it? But I saw that yesterday, all your boys are out of school right now. It is summer. You spent the whole day like shuttling three boys around. How are you alive and sane? Because I don't have kids, so I'm very fascinated by this. It seems like a lot of work. Tell me how you do it.
Yeah, I'm terrified about summer, to be honest. My oldest is in has been in pre-K, and he's going to be doing pre-K twice. So it'll be, you know, it's 9 to 3:40, which I'm spoiled rotten because the school that he goes to is literally across the street. So I've been home with the younger two, you know, during the school year, and it's just the hustle and bustle in the morning to get him to school and then pick up at 3:40. And then the last couple hours of the day before my husband gets home is hard. But, I don't know, because in theory, the almost 5-year-old, he's going to be 5 in a couple weeks, is the easiest because he's, you know, like self-sufficient and go to the bathroom by himself. But the older two fight and there's complications, like he throws temper tantrums still. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I did, after I had been doing this my podcast for a while, I did invest in a babysitter. So once a week, I do have a babysitter. So that is my saving grace right now.
But that's still only once a week. Which one is the easiest? So for anyone who doesn't know, Marshall is the oldest. Marshall is 5 or turning 5?
Mm-hmm. He'll be 5 this month.
Okay. Oh, that's exciting. Do you have a birthday party planned?
Well, it's in 2 weeks, and I just put a Facebook event together.
Perfect.
And I invited some school friends and, you know, my sisters and their kids and Glenn's sisters and their kids. And I just texted out all the family and I said, FYI, this is what we're doing. Don't feel like you have to make the trip, though.
Perfect. I didn't get that text, but Let me go back and check. Maybe I just, like, didn't see it. But, yeah, I mean, I'm in. Let's do this.
Bring Ellie.
Yeah, of course. And how old is Lewis now?
Lewis is 2.5.
And Russell is 8 months.
8 months, just about, yep.
Okay. Who's the easiest and who's the hardest?
So, Lewis has always been a very easy kid, like an easy baby, all things considered. He is now, and an easy 2-year-old. Now he's 2.5. He's now showing his true colors of a 2-year-old, and it has gotten significantly more difficult in the past couple months. He's still, like, so funny and hilarious and awesome. But 2, I almost forgot how hard the age 2 was, because 3 was so difficult with my oldest that I didn't even think, oh yeah, 2 was hard, you know? So, just yesterday I was losing my mind, and, I actually saw a lady in the bathroom when I had all 3 of them, and she said, oh, I don't know how you do it with 3. And, you know, I just have my 1 and I don't know how to go to the bathroom with him. And then she said, oh, but at least the older 2 are somewhat self-sufficient. And I was like, well, the 2-year-old is definitely not. I mean, he can walk by himself. And Lewis, he's very delayed in his speech. He doesn't really talk yet, which makes things frustrating when he wants something or wants to express something or tell you something, because he doesn't really know how to get the words out yet. So, but they're all hard and easy in different times. And I mean, honestly, it's the best thing ever. I mean, it's so hard and so awesome at the same time.
Yeah. Between you, Glenn, and the 3 kids, you've got a basketball team.
Yeah. And so, it's all boys. So that's good.
Except you holding it down.
I think I'm more so wired to raise boys. So I don't know if we'll ever have any more kids, but if we do and we ever have a girl, I will lose my mind because I will be so shocked.
Yeah, but she will have the best, like, support system. Good. If you have a girl, good luck to her ever, like, bringing home a date. I mean, she's just, that'll be great. So can you walk me through? I'm very interested in what a day in the life is like for you in terms of, because you mentioned shuttling the kids around and all that, but you also, and we'll talk about running more as we go on, but you're also, you run a lot. You have a dog, you have a husband, you have a podcast, you have a lot going on. So what's a day in the life look like for you?
Okay. So, I usually wake up around 5:30 or 6, and that's just kind of my natural alarm clock. And that might be kind of generous. Sometimes my natural alarm clock is closer to 6:30, but, anywhere in between there. And I try to read when I get up in the morning, and we have this like owl clock in the older kids' room. They share a room, and it turns green when they are allowed to get up, which is 7 o'clock. So I really try to get up at least by 6 so I can drink my hot lemon water and read my book and just kind of like start my day that way instead of start my day serving people and like waiting on kids. And so then at 7, I'm like, okay, Lindsay, shut everything off and like you are theirs for now. You know, and my husband leaves for work at 7:30, and usually it's get the little guy down for a nap by 8:30, which is crazy early. I know he gets up around 7 and he naps at like 8:30, and then we get Marshall to school, and then haul the little guys to the Y, work out, do a little bit of work, come home, nap them, make lunch, nap them. I mean, it's all very systematic. And at nap time, I'm always torn, and I think any mom who's home with their kids will say this, always torn between, do I sit down for 30 minutes and like read or hang out, or do I fold laundry? Do I work? Do I schedule interviews? It's pretty routine though, and pretty, I hate to say mundane, but you know, day in and day out. And then I do schedule podcast interviews for my show during nap time, which that is on a little bit of a hiatus right now because my middle guy is not in his crib anymore. So he's on the loose in the house. Like I can't predict if he'll get out of his room or not. So that's kind of changing. But yeah, and then when Glenn gets home, we make dinner and hang out and put the kids to bed. It's not that exciting.
Well, but it's very interesting to me. Like that seems like a very busy and challenging day. I know you're saying it's mundane. That to me, that's, you've got a lot going on.
Yeah, and I try really hard to, I have to separate things. So like, I try really hard to be full on mom mode when I need to be full on mom mode and put my phone away or do whatever. And then when I'm doing my work stuff or whatever, I try to separate that so that I find a different, sort of like a different identity in this other stuff. Because I always say, I think some moms, and I have friends that are stay-at-home moms who are so good at that. And I have never viewed myself as someone who is so good at that. Like I don't live and breathe it. Like my sister-in-law, for instance, she kind of lives and breathes it, like all things kids. And I love my kids dearly, but I go crazy with just that, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's why, you know, I do the podcast stuff and the running and all that, because I have to kind of find my own thing, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned Glenn. You know, I love talking about Glenn.
I know. You love Glenn as much as I love Brian.
Yes, I know. Glenn, but the thing is, you can get your Brian fix anytime because Brian is all over the internet. I feel very deprived of my friend Glenn since he quit Twitter.
Yep.
And I really thought that was going to be a temporary thing, but he has not come back that I know of.
It's been a while.
He must be so much happier without it. I sometimes think that I would be a lot happier without the internet.
I know.
Tell me about how you met, because I know that I've heard the story, but I love the story of how you met Glenn, mostly because it basically involves you being so sassy. So
yes.
Tell me about how open you were to having a relationship with Glenn when you guys met.
Yeah, so I worked at the Village Deli, which is a restaurant in Bloomington at IU, and I was a waitress, a breakfast restaurant, and Glenn was a line cook. And I just kind of like a lot of the, this sounds so bad, I guess, but a lot of the line cooks there were people that came to IU, to Bloomington, went to school for like a year and dropped out, and they were just line cooks at the Village Deli, which is fine if that's your, you know, ambition, whatever. And I kind of thought he was one of those guys. So my friend Emily and I, we would kind of always make lists like, who are the top five guys at the Village Deli or whatever.
Amazing.
Just, you know, because we're like, how old were we, 20? I don't know, whatever. So Glenn was on my list, though. And I just kind of thought, oh, whatever, this will be fun if he like wants to hang out. And I didn't think anything of it. And actually, the first time I found out who he was, I waited on his parents. Did you know that?
I did. Well, I remember you saying that when you and him shared your story.
Okay.
Yes, I love it.
I waited on his parents and they were like, hey, can you bring Glenn out? We're his parents. And I, you know, I'm loud and I sing and I dance and Glenn's pretty reserved and quiet and he's not an introvert, but he does not say words unless words need to be said. Okay. And I like prance in and I'm like, who's Glenn? And he's on the toast, and they're like, he's the guy on the toast, and so I sent
He's on the toast. I feel like that's a phrase that I want to use in my everyday life. Oh, well, he's on the toast.
And it's actually a good phrase, because the toast is kind of like a very unimportant job in the world of kitchens, of working like the line in a breakfast restaurant. So he was kind of newer, so he was on the toast. If he were a big deal, he would have been on the pancakes. Yeah, and he actually turned into a pretty good big deal. He was a good line cook.
He was anyway, a pretty big deal at the Village Deli.
He was one of the best cooks. And actually, the perk for me dating him was when it got really busy and maybe I forgot to put an order in or something like that, I could kind of give him my ticket and be like, hey, I forgot to get this in there. You're my boyfriend, so sneak it in the line. But anyway, so, and my friend Emily was like, and not that education matters, but whatever. Obviously, I was held this to a higher standard. But my friend Emily was like, well, you know, Glenn's in the business school, right?
Ooh.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, really? Okay. Well, all right then. Points for Glenn. But yeah, so we started dating in I think like 2 months in. I don't know if we told this part of the story in my episode with him, but I tried to break up with him and he was basically like, no, that's not happening. There's no reason for that. You're just running away for no reason. And so we started dating in July, and apparently in September, his parents came down to visit for the first time, you know, since we were dating, and we all went out to dinner, and I guess he told his mom in the hotel room that he was going to marry me, which is kind of crazy.
Aww.
Because we were 21.
Yeah, babies.
Know? Yeah. And we were entering our senior year of college. So I'm like, at least I got 3 years of fun college times in, right? Before I met my husband. So.
And I feel like you guys have a lot of fun now. You go to concerts. You're like making babies left and right. I mean, you seem to have a good time. So.
Yeah, we very much value getting a babysitter and going out and doing things for ourselves, because I would go crazy if we didn't do that.
I wish I lived closer. Imagine how much fun I would have with your kids. Lewis and I, we would have fashion shows. It would be amazing.
He'd be wearing your shoes. I feel like you're really protective about your slippers, and he'd probably be trying to wear your slippers.
I have my slippers on right now, so I love that you just said that. I was like getting ready to record this, and I was like, oh, do you know what? Let me go put my slippers on. I am pretty intense about my slippers. Just, I love them so much.
Lou would have his feet in your slippers.
And that would be fine. There are not many people I would share my slippers with, so. But I would let Big Lou have them, because I know he would style them well. He'd wear them with something really inspiring. So, all right, so that's how you met Glenn. How did he propose? Is that a good story?
Not really. I mean, it's a fine story, but
sick burn.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's just the typical, like, we went to Chicago and we were on, I think it's the Navy Pier or something, and he proposed there. But, you know, it's always like, and it's so different now. I mean, we've been married for 9 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I always say, like, proposals in public are real awkward, right?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. That was like, I remember being terrified, and I knew Brian wouldn't, but I was just like, do not ever put and look, if you're a girl who wants this, that's fine. But for me, I was like, don't put a ring in a cake that I have to bite into at a dessert. I don't want an audience. I don't want the whole thing where, like, surprise, our family is there. I just, as I've gotten older, I don't do well with, like, crowds and overwhelming situations. I very much, like, need to be able to process things. So yes, he proposed on the pier. Were there people around?
Not really. Like, there were people out walking around and stuff. But I remember very clearly thinking, it was like the point, you know, everybody acts like they're super surprised. But I kind of, like, when we were out there, I was like, oh,
you knew,
like, something could be happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, I hope nobody's watching. So romantic, you know. But yeah. So, and actually, I remember I had a phone call job interview the next day. And I don't think at this stage in my life I would be preoccupied by that, but I was fresh out of college, so I was real nervous about it. I don't even remember what it was for. And so the whole night we went out to dinner and everything, and I was like anxious about this stupid phone call that ruined the night almost, you know?
Oh no.
But man, it seems like ages ago. I look back at pictures from them. I mean, we were babies. We were 24. Yeah, we were 24. So we got married when we were 25.
But I also remember thinking, like, I know that for me, I remember being 25 and thinking, like, it's time for me to get married now. Just because, like, our parents' generation, they did get married. Like, my parents got married when they were 23. They were high school sweethearts. Ugh. And they got married at 23. So I think I always thought I would be on their timeline, like, married 23, first kid 25, second kid 27. Here I am at 32. And I'm, like, ready to collect dogs.
When did you guys get married? What year did you get married?
We got married in 2015, so it'll be 2 years in September. And I was 30 when we got married.
And that seems pretty normal these days.
Yeah, especially in the New York area. Like, here, I would say, of my college friends, I was one of the last to get married. But of my friends here in New York, many of whom I met through running, I was, like, the first to get married.
Yeah, man, my best friend is not married. She, you know, dates around or whatever. She does all the dating apps. But we're 33. Yeah, she's 33 now. And I'm like, man, Indianapolis is a hard place to be single and in your 30s because it is kind of, you know, it's the Midwest.
Settled down.
People get married younger. Mm-hmm. I think even if she was in Chicago or something like that, it would be easier. But there's just, I feel like people get married and have babies younger here.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, here in New York. I think because here no one can afford it. No one can afford their rent and a kid. It's just like, insane. But, you know, we're slowly moving away. And so, you know, we made the first step. We moved to New Jersey. And we have a dog, so that's like, you know, we're getting there. We'll see.
But you're still so close to the city. I mean, you're
5 seconds.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't consider myself not in the city, which I'm sure drives people in New York crazy. Because I still say when people are like, oh, where are you from? Oh, New York City. Sometimes I'll say New Jersey, but like, I know, I still say it. I still think I'm a New Yorker. So, but let's talk about you. And I want to talk about, you were on the cover of Women's Running Magazine.
This is true.
In, what was that, 2014?
It must have been, yeah, because Lewis was born in 2015.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So part of the reason that you were on the cover, they did a cover runner search contest, which you won, which is amazing and very belated. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
So part of what got you that cover, in addition to being amazing and inspiring and wonderful, is you had pretty recently undergone a prophylactic double mastectomy. Did I say that right?
I knew you were wondering if you were going to say it right. Yes.
Yes. Okay. I want to talk about that because I think that's a really interesting part of your story that people don't often hear about because you're always asking people questions. I would love to hear that story because it's something that I don't really understand or know a lot about, but tell me about discovering the gene mutation that you had and going through that whole process.
Okay. So I always try, I will try to make this not very like a long-winded thing. And feel free to interject with questions if you have them.
Oh, I will.
So dates back to, so my grandma had breast cancer in her 40s and she survived that 20 years later. She found it very late and oh gosh, she tried to do some like hippy dippy, pray it away camp thing, which her doctors advised her not to do. And then came back from that very, very sick and ended up doing chemo and having the mastectomy and all that. And I mean, pretty much a miracle that she survived because she waited so long to do treatment and it was already stage 4. So anyway, that was, you know, back in the early 90s, we were really little. I remember she would wear a wig and my little sister would call her grandma with the curly hair.
Oh,
because her hair wig was curly. But then 20 years later, I guess it was 20 years. Yeah. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, which, sometimes can be related to the breast cancer. And so at that point, she went ahead and got this gene test for the BRCA gene, which the BRCA gene, I think it was discovered. So everybody has the BRCA gene, but I have a mutation in the gene. So you have the gene, mm-hmm. but you're probably not, your gene is probably not mutated. I think that gene was discovered in like the 90s or whatever. So it wasn't real popular to get the test until, you know, into the 2000s. And so she got the test and the deal is that when your parents is diagnosed with the gene, you have a 50% chance of inheriting the gene. And so, and what that does is it puts you at a higher risk for breast and ovarian cancer and then some other cancers as well. But those are the two that are really, that the risk is high enough that it's a really big deal. And it's 86% chance of increased risk of breast cancer. And I believe my ovarian is somewhere in the 40s. My risk for that is maybe it's 46%, something like that. So anyway, my mom has 3 sisters and they all got tested and 2 are positive and 1 is negative. So my mom's positive for the gene. And I remember when my mom found out she had the gene mutation, my mom is a very like, she's very, okay, I find something out, I do something about it, I move on. She doesn't get super fearful about things. She kind of is more of a, I'm going to take action kind of person. And so, I remember I had just had I was literally having a miscarriage and like I was in the process of miscarrying my first pregnancy. I know. And I showed up to my parents' house and, Glenn and I drove down for the day. I mean, I'm like, this is super personal, but like, I'm like bleeding, you know, I'd already been to the doctor and the doctor calls my mom on the weekend and I'm like, what's that about? Why are they calling you? And she was like, oh, okay, my test is positive. And I'm like, crying, like, oh my gosh, I'm miscarrying my baby. You have the gene. And that doesn't mean you have cancer, but whatever. It was just, I remember being so emotional and like, and honestly, and this is so selfish, but just scared that I had it. When she told me she had it, selfishly, I was just terrified that I had it. But maybe some people who are nicer than me might have been more concerned about their mom. Because at that point, I was only 50% chance that I had it. And my mom wasn't really sad about it or anything. She was just kind of like, well, I gotta have surgery now and, you know, deal with this.
And is that what it is? Like, if you have it, you get the surgery? Like, if you test positive, it's like a given that you're gonna have surgery?
No, it's okay. Totally elective. It's totally, you know, what you want to do. Mm-hmm. At the time, my mom was, I think she was 48 or something like that. So obviously done having babies and all that. And it really made, I guess I can't say it made no sense not to, because some people choose not to. But for her, she felt like it really made no sense not to go ahead and do the preventative surgery, especially because her mom, you know, at the time had ovarian cancer and had already had breast cancer.
Right.
And her mom had breast cancer in her late 40s. So, and she was like right at that age. So I put off having the test though. And my mom had the cert, she had a double mastectomy and she did the hysterectomy as well, because she was already kind of at the age where she was entering menopause. And so I put the test off because I was just scared and I didn't want to know. And my sisters both went ahead and got their test. They didn't really care. They were kind of like, I'm just going to get the test and see and go from there. They weren't paralyzed with fear like I was. And they were both negative.
Oh.
I know. So I just let this monster like eat at me. Like, think about it all the time. Like, do I have it? Do I have it? Do I have it?
What does the test entail?
Oh, it's just blood work. The test is not scary. It's not scary to get the test.
Right.
It was just knowing the results that was
right.
scary to me.
So when both your sisters, when they found out that they were negative, were you like, that means I'm probably negative too? Or were you like, that means I'm probably more likely to be positive?
I was like, that's probably means I'm positive.
Yeah.
What are the odds that all three of us are negative?
Right.
And I was like, of course, me, the warrior, is the one that worries all the time, is the positive one. So so this was probably at least a year after I found out one of my sisters didn't have it. I don't remember the process, like the timeline for them, but I was training for a half Ironman. This was in 2013. And I just ran. Yeah, I waited till after I had my son. And which was crazy too, because when you breastfeed, you get like all kinds of knots and lumps and weird things in your milk ducts that clog. And so anytime anything happened with that, I was like, what is that lump? Is that breast Aww. Cancer? Like, what is that? But it would normally just be like, you know, milk clogging up a little bit. And so that whole time was super fearful for me, because I let it be, you know, I wasn't controlling my feelings and my thoughts. And, so anyway, after I had him, I trained really hard. And I think that was kind of my way to deal with, A, the anxiety of having a baby and getting through the emotional piece there. But also that was always in the back of my mind. And I was like, well, if I just keep running and doing this, this is like, you know, a way to burn my energy and the thoughts I'm feeling and that I can use that towards running. So I ran 3 marathons by the time he was 9 months old, which is insane
wow.
to me now. Yes. Like my baby now, my third baby is 8 months old and I have not yet run a marathon.
But you ran a very speedy half, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a good half recently. So I think I was using all that energy on running. And so anyway, when he was 9 months old, I ran what still stands today, my marathon PR. And I was super burnt out with running because I obviously just spent all that time and energy on it. And I decided I wanted to train for a half Ironman. Well, my husband had done an Ironman the year before, so it was kind of like a seed in my head already. I'd seen what training went into it and everything. But my whole point with that is that I would be doing things that were out of my comfort zone. I didn't know how to swim. I had never swam more than like 3 laps when I was in swim club in the slowest lane when I was 8. I was the worst kid on the team, and I did it for a year maybe. I never even entered a meet because I was so bad. And so I would be swimming laps. And actually, you know, if you go from running to swimming and biking, you have a lot more time to think in your head. At least I did, because when I would run, I would be either running with someone and talking to them, or I would be listening to music in my headphones. This was before I listened to podcasts, so I wouldn't be doing that. But I noticed I had a lot more time to think about life and everything when I was on the bike and in the pool, especially in the pool, because you're just swimming lap. You know what I mean? That's all you got. And so it was eating away at me, this test. And so I finally was like, while I was training, I was like, I'm doing this. I'm scheduling this appointment. I think I scheduled the appointment like in the locker room at the gym to get my blood test. And actually it was around the time that Angelina Jolie came out. And I remember being pissed because I was like, man, Angelina Jolie, why you got to make this be all over the news right now? I'm already trying not to think about it all the time. And now it's everywhere.
So didn't you get your results like right before your race?
Oh, yeah. So my results took a while to get in. It was supposed to be like a few days turnaround. And it had been like a week and then another week. And I'm like, what is going on? So I called and they're like, oh, yeah, it got sent to the wrong lab, blah, blah, blah. So then I remember I was making granola in my kitchen and Marshall, I think, had just gotten up from a nap and the doctor called. And you know when the doctor called, I mean, you know this, you've dealt with just as many, if not more, plenty more health issues than I have. You know when it's the doctor that's calling, it's not a good thing. Like, you want the nurse to call.
Yeah, or no phone call at all.
Or no phone call at all. And so it was it's like, hey, this is Dr. Hughes. And I'm like, oh, not who I wanted to hear from. Because also, it's like when you get a pap smear, like you get something in the mail that says everything's normal. If it's normal, like, nobody calls you.
Right.
So she called and we talked about it. And I was like, you know, trying not to cry. And then, you know, Marshall was right there. And I was like, oh, I have to be a mom. Like, I'm scared right now. And it's not like it was a cancer diagnosis. But to me, it was a scary thing to hear. And I remember being really grateful that I had him. Like, I was just holding him. And I was just thinking, I'm glad I'm not alone right now. You know, because on a normal day, I'd be at work in my office. Or, you know, Glenn wouldn't be with me or whatever. But I just have the presence of someone else, even if it was a baby who wasn't even, you know, who just turned 1 year old, you know.
That might be better. They're like the best little company.
Yeah, but it was kind of like action immediately when I found out, because I wanted to do something about it. So I made appointments with the breast surgeon and everything, and we scheduled, you know, I had to get a mammogram and I had to get an MRI and had to get my ovaries checked out and all that stuff. And the whole time I was thinking, you know, my mom kept saying, Lindsay, it's normal, you're just getting these tests to rule everything out, you're not getting these tests because you found something. But I was still like, yeah, but what if? And so actually, yeah, I had all that done the week before my half Ironman. And I remember being in the athlete's village the day before the race, picking up my packet and stuff. And I had been waiting all day to get the phone call that said my MRI was normal, because you get a mammogram. At least when I got my mammogram, they told me that day, everything looks fine. So I already knew that, but the MRI is what really, you know, shows a lot more. And so finally they called me at like 4:30 p.m. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm your last call of the day. And she said everything was great. And so I, you know, it kind of almost made, even though I hadn't had my surgery yet, I hadn't taken those steps, it kind of made the half Ironman, which was a big sort of monumental thing in my life anyway, because I was stepping out of my comfort zone, doing things I had never done before. It was kind of like the race was such a celebration to me, because I had this such relief off my shoulders, you know?
So when did you go ahead and have the surgery?
Okay, yeah. So the race was July and I had the surgery in October. And it was actually October 2nd, I believe. And I remember we stayed the night in Bloomington and Marshall stayed at my parents' house. And Glenn and I just drove up to Indy, just the two of us. And I remember we kind of like sat in silence the whole car ride. Yeah. And then, you know, you can't eat when you have surgery. And he was starving. And so he stopped at Panera or something and like ate a bagel right in front of me. And I wanted to punch him in his face.
Oh, what? Okay. This is not the same. But the first time I had to get a colonoscopy, I was dating this guy who, like, he lived in Connecticut at the time. I was living in the city. And I was like, I need someone to get me home because you have to go under anesthesia. And I was like, will you come down and come with me? And of course, he was horrible. But he agreed to do it. And then we're on our way to the hospital in the morning and I couldn't eat. And I was like so nervous. And he's like, I just want to stop and get a bacon, egg and cheese. He ate his bacon, egg and cheese in the waiting room with all the people waiting to go in to get colonoscopies.
Oh, no.
I know. I should have broken up with him right there. Right, but then I was just like, I need you to get me home. I will date you for another year and a half. But then I'm going to break up with you.
This solidified it, but I'm going to still hang out around a little bit longer.
Yep. Well,
at this point, I was already married, so I was already stuck. And I had a kid.
You had a kid. Yeah, you had to stay with him. So were you nervous about the surgery?
Yeah, I was really scared because I had never been under anesthesia. I had my wisdom teeth out, so it's like that conscious sedation type thing, which you're out for that, but not really. It's like I think a lot of people have this fear that one of my biggest fears is like I'm gonna wake up during surgery, and I think that's such a typical thing for people to think. And it's a long surgery because they removed all my as much breast. There's always the risk that there's breast tissue left behind, right? So they removed as much breast tissue as they possibly could, and then the breast surgeon does that, and then the plastic surgeon is also there, and she puts in expanders. So it's like a teamwork. It's like the breast surgeon does the first half, and then the plastic surgeon comes in and does the second half, and then tidies everything up. So I want to say it's like six, it was like 6 hour surgery.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I remember too, we were in the room getting prepped, and I just remember thinking like, man, nobody made me feel more calm and at ease than the nurses that were taking care of me. And I remember thinking like, man, these nurses have such an important job. They're prepping me for surgery, but their job is to make me feel comfortable and safe. Like this is a routine thing. We do this all the time. And it's crazy because you get this emotional connection with them, and then you get shipped off to surgery and you never see them
I
again.
know. Nurses are the best. If you're listening and you're a nurse, I'll have
We
like
love you.
a nurse's appreciation show because I mean, I'm right there with you. Like, nurses are amazing and they just make or break. I hate to say make or break the experience. Obviously, the outcome of the surgery
It's
is
true,
what's
though.
ultimately important. But yeah, especially beforehand, it's like that job is so important. And
Yeah, you're
so,
not hanging out with your doctor.
yeah, no. Not at all. I never even see my doctor. So I'm sure this is a stupid question. Having the surgery, so you tested positive for the gene mutation. Did having the surgery, the double mastectomy, did that like, I hate to say ensure that you'll never get breast cancer, but like what did that do or what risk did that eliminate?
You're never insured, which is like the
Right.
scary thing anyway, but it significantly decreases your odds because you're getting rid of like the tissue where that mutation might have, I don't know all the science behind it, but like you're getting rid of most of the tissue where something might come up. But yeah, it's your risk is never zero. That being said, it puts my risk for at least for breast cancer, lower than the average person who doesn't have a
Okay.
gene mutation.
And what was, and testing positive, if you hadn't had the surgery, what would your risk have been of getting breast cancer?
It's like 86%.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, it's
That's.
crazy. And it's in your lifetime. And of course, your risk goes up as you age. But the thing about the BRCA gene mutation is they don't really talk a lot about age. It can happen anytime. So it's kind of like, okay, well, I'm not just gonna, and then I would have to be getting MRIs like every 6 months and
Oof.
always, and I still have to get looked at and everything. And I think I'm supposed to have MRIs like once every 3 years or something like that, just to check everything out. But it's not that consistent, waiting for the appointment, waiting for the results. The other thing though is your risk for ovarian cancer does go up to, like I said, I think it's in the 40s. Now, you would think I would have this memorized, but
No.
I haven't delved into it as much recently. But so I do have to get an ultrasound of my ovaries every 6 months, and then I do a blood test. It's called CA125, which what that tests for is like inflammation in your pelvic area. And so, I mean, that's kind of a regular thing that most people don't have to do. That kind of causes me some anxiety. But though I don't like that it's every 6 months, it's kind of a good thing because, I mean, then you're really on it. I mean, you're catching everything super early. And even though ovarian cancer is a really scary cancer to get, I mean, you're really on checking everything out.
You had reconstructive surgery as well,
Yeah.
but that isn't right after. That's like months later, right?
So, okay, yeah, like I was saying earlier, the plastic surgeon is part of the actual mastectomy where they put the expanders in. So then, after your first 6 weeks and you're kind of healed up a little bit, you go back into the plastic surgeon's office every so often, I don't, every other week or every 4 weeks or something, and they fill you up. They give you a little syringe of fluid and they pump your expanders.
Oh.
Yeah. So you get stretched out a little bit at a time, so it's not like a big shock to your system. And so I would remember I would always have Marshall with me, and I would go into the plastic surgeon's office and get a little injection in my boobs. And it's funny because the expanders, when you have those in, they're hard as a rock. So like you hug me if you get real close and my boobs are just like rocks.
It's like in Mean Girls. It's like Amy Poehler's character in Mean Girls with the rock hard boobs.
Yeah, so I got that. I got filled until I was, you know, where I wanted to be, which is funny because when I had the surgery, it was a year after I had been breastfeeding. And so like I was done breastfeeding, so my boobs were like deflated. And I was also like the smallest I've probably been since I was like 15 years old because I had been training for that half Ironman. And man, you can't get out of half Ironman training without losing some weight, at least for me, because I was working out twice a day, most days a week. So anything, any boob size was like big to me because I had nothing at that point.
And then I'm sure, again, I know this is going to sound like a stupid question, but I want to ask it anyway. So you breastfed with Marshall, and then once you had the mastectomy and reconstruction, breastfeeding is not an option then, correct?
Right. Yeah. Okay. There's no breastfeeding because your body doesn't have all that. I guess, you know what though? So, and this is a little bit personal, but this is a big decision actually. So if anybody's listening in there, they're in the same boat as me and they're going down the road of having looking into having a preventative mastectomy. I had chosen nipple sparing surgery. So I actually have my original nipples.
Oh.
Since I didn't have cancer to start with. So it does leave you at a little bit of a higher risk because you have a little more tissue left over around your nipples. But I remember my surgeon afterwards, he was like, I worked really hard on you, like, you know, getting all the tissue around then and then sewing it back up because they like open it up and they sew it back up. So there is a little bit, it's funny because my feeling in my chest is like pretty numb and strange. I have with my other two babies had a little bit of a sensation like of milk coming in.
Oh.
Yeah, like I could feel like that my body was like wanting to do that almost.
That's so interesting. Our bodies are so intuitive and smart, aren't they?
Yes. It's crazy. Yes.
And did you have any, I know you mentioned that you actually had two miscarriages before Marshall, correct?
Yeah, I had a miscarriage probably a year and a half or so before. And then I actually had a miscarriage right before I got pregnant with Marshall. Like I got pregnant with Marshall before I even had my period. Yeah. So, I had two miscarriages.
And then were you able to, obviously it was after the surgery and everything. What about with Lewis and Russell? Everything was fine with your pregnancy, with getting pregnant? Let me get just so personal with you. Let's talk about your nipples and then tell me about getting pregnant and how that all worked.
Well, how you get pregnant is there's a guy and a girl. And they told me that it shouldn't affect any of that at all. Especially with the mastectomy, because I mean, we weren't messing with my ovaries or anything like that. So yeah, that was, I really didn't have any issues at all getting, once I decided let's go ahead and try with Lewis. We got pregnant pretty fast. So then with Russell was not really planned. Like we wanted to have a third baby, but we weren't necessarily like, let's do this already. So, you know, but we were not, we knew that like the chances of getting pregnant were high because I don't take birth control because I don't like how it makes me feel. So yeah. I've never, ever since, I haven't taken birth control in like 8 years. So, and since it took us so long, it took us quite a while. I know that sounds crazy because we still had Marshall pretty young. Like I was 29 when I had him. I had not been on birth control for like 4 years though. So it took us a while to get pregnant with him. And then, you know, the two miscarriages leading up. So I was kind of the mindset, like, I know we want to have more kids than this. And if I put myself on birth control and then it takes even longer, like I don't want to delay this process. So we kind of just of the mindset, if we get pregnant, we get pregnant and that's a great thing. And so, but now I'm like, dear God, I do not want to be pregnant right now.
Yeah. I feel like you're very often either pregnant or you have a baby. So like in the whole time that I've like known you, you've either been pregnant or with a baby. So
give me at least another year from now, at least another year.
All right. Well, let's talk about how running factors into that. And I want to know about how you came to be such a talented runner. You mentioned that you had a really good half recently. You ran like casually growing up, right? Like high school, college, you ran.
Right. Yeah. I ran in high school. I did run cross country, and I remember my freshman year, my best friend Sarah was on the cross country team, and I was like, that sounds awful. And I went up, I did track with her that year just for fun, because you know, you're that age, you're just trying everything out. And I was like sort of good, but not really good. And the distance coach kind of pinned me like, you need to run cross country. So I did. And I was pretty good for my team. I mean, our team was decent, but we weren't great. But I was always on varsity for the most part. And so I got to run in the Indiana State meet my junior and senior year. And I was usually like the third or fourth or fifth girl on the team, something like that. And so anyway, then in college, I was super glad that cross country was over, because I would always get anxious and nervous and stressed about races. So I was like glad to just run for fun and do that. And so then junior year of college, I ran my first half marathon. I don't think I ran more than 6 miles leading up to it, but I got in my head that I wanted to break 2 hours for some reason. And I think I ran like a 1:59 something, 30 or something. It was miserable and awful. And then the next year, Glenn and I ran it. The next year I had met Glenn and he ran it with me. And then we just kind of got hooked in. We ran our first marathon the summer we got married. We got married, we bought a house, and we ran our first marathon, because that was all, you know,
that's
cute. One of those things wouldn't have been enough.
Exactly. And the first half that you ran together, who was faster?
I think, okay, there's a couple stories though. I think the first time we did it, he was faster, but then the next year, so the Indianapolis mini marathon, there's a 500 festival mini marathon every year. It's like one of the biggest halves in the country. You run around the speedway. It's a really cool race. And so we kind of just do that every year. But I think it was the second year we ran it, we went out together, and around mile six, you enter the track and you run for 2 miles around the 500 track. We lost each other somewhere on the track. I mean, it's a huge race and we're not way in the front. So there's people everywhere. And we ended up finishing within like, I think 20 seconds of each other, but I beat him.
Yes.
So we split up, but we clearly still ran basically the same race. And I remember I saw him in the finishing chute and he was behind me and I was like, yes. And then he was annoyed because he thought I kind of like ditched him on
purpose. Oh, shut up, Glenn. Get over it. You're fine.
But I did beat him in our first marathon.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we went out to San Diego and ran the Rock and Roll Marathon, and I had run, that was the same year at the mini, weeks before, I had run a 1:37, and which was way faster than I thought, like, was in my wheelhouse. And so I remember being at the expo, and we were so novice. I mean, we had never ran a marathon, and, you know, we were being, like, the uber dorks, like, visiting all the tables at the expo. Like, we never, you know, these days, you just go straight to get your packet and leave. At least I do. And so there was this pace tent and you know, local guys that had pace bands. And I told them what I'd run my half in, like any huge dork runner would do, like start talking about their time.
Of course.
At the expo. And they were like, oh, you could probably qualify for Boston with that time. So then I was like, oh, shoot.
Now this is in my head.
Yeah, because, you know, I think a lot of people, they train for their first marathon, they sort of have a time goal in their head, but it's kind of like, I just want to complete this. But my whole thing was, I want to break 4 hours. Like, that sounds good to me. So then he got that in my head, and we had Timex watches. Like, we didn't, you know, I don't even know if anybody had Garmin's yet. It was 2008. So I had my little Timex watch, and we got to the race at like 6 a.m. and didn't start. Yeah, you know, I mean, we were there like 3 hours early or something stupid like that. And we ran the first 17 miles together, and he was just like slowing down, and I was feeling good. And I remember at one point we were carrying like energy bars or something with us. Like, we weren't even just taking gels. I literally think we had like granola bars on us. And he dropped one. So I like turned around and ran back and got his granola bar for him. And
Aww.
And this other guy had started running with us too. And this guy was like taking us on as his mentors. He was like, how many marathons have you ran? What are you trying to do? And I'm all like, zero marathons. I'm trying to crawl through Boston, I guess. And at that point, you're looking at your watch. You don't know what your pace is. You're just looking at the time lapsed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I ended up telling Glenn, I was like, look, I think I can do this and I'm going to have to leave you.
And was so, he mad?
No, he was like, go on. And there was this like turnaround part where we can kind of see each other, like you loop. And so I, you know, by like mile 22, I had put at least a half a mile on him. I was pretty, you know, I was pretty far. I ended up beating him by 10 minutes, which is a lot by leaving him at mile 17. But then I ran with that random guy for like the next, until like mile 25. And so we always joke that I had a race boyfriend.
Oh, I love that you call him random guy, though. In that time, you didn't learn his name?
I don't remember. I remember that he thought I was his mentor and I had never run a marathon. But I also remember hitting mile 25 thinking, and there were these military jets flying overhead thinking like, I really just want them to drop bombs on me right now because I felt like my organs were failing. I was like, I think I'm going to die, but I have to get to this finish line. And I ended up running like 3:39, which at that time, the BQ time was 3:40. And also it wasn't so hard to get in. Like, you know, now mm-hmm. you have to qualify by like at least 2 minutes. And that wasn't the case. So that minute secured me a spot. But then at the finish line, I remember looking around waiting for him and it felt like an hour. And all I wanted to do was hug him and, Aww. You know, whatever. And anyway, he finally finished.
Good job, Glenn.
You have to see his finish line picture. It's hilarious. His arms are raised and he looks like he's about to die. And he's got like his shorts are so long. They're down to his knees and he's wearing like a technical t-shirt, which you know, these days he'd be in like short, almost
singlet
shorts and like a singlet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just so funny to look back on where we were then.
I would love to see that photo, like yeah, more than anything.
I will send it to you because I have it.
Thank
it
you.
Is so funny. And so I was like, I'm not running another marathon. I don't want to do that again. That is awful. And then I signed up for Boston because I felt like I had to because people work so hard to qualify. And I was qualified on my first marathon, you know? So I did it and it was miserable too.
And how many marathons have you done now?
I think 13. And
wow.
I'm annoyed at myself for saying I think because it's one of those things where I'm like, how do people not know exactly how many? But I actually haven't run a marathon since 2014.
But you're running one this year?
Yes, I plan to run the Monumental Marathon here in Indy.
Yay! And that's perfect because you forget how horrible it is.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know. I remember, I'm terrified of what that last 10K is going to feel like, but I'm really excited because I know what I'm capable of, and I'm a much smarter runner now, and I'm more confident. Like, it's funny because, so I've been running for so long now, and going into races now, I just know what's in my wheelhouse. Like, I just know what I can do and what I'm capable of. And I think when you're first starting out, that is part of the scary part is part of not knowing what you're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn would tell me I'm capable of way more than I think I am. But it's fun to go into a race calculated almost. Like, calculated knowing I put in these workouts, I did these long runs, I have this experience. And it's really hard to trump experience, you know?
Yeah.
That's such a huge part of running marathons is that having the experience under your belt, knowing how to handle the mental side of finishing the race.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still not there. So I aspire to be where you are someday. I still don't know how much to let things hurt. Like, that's something that I struggle with. And I mean, I haven't raced a marathon in a long time, but even with shorter stuff or even with track workouts, I never mm-hmm. quite know, like, how much more should I push? Or not so much can I push, but I'm just kind of like, should I try to go faster now? I'm just so afraid of, like, dying toward the end. As a coach, do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, I think that most people can work a lot harder than they're working. I mean, I know that sounds really, like, that probably sounds bad, but aside from physical pain where you're hurting because you have an injury, I think a lot of people are scared to push themselves to the point where they're really seeing big gains. That being said, what you were saying, like when you're doing a workout, I'm afraid to push now so that I, you know, I want to be able to finish this workout. Say you're doing 8x800 or something like that. Yeah, you shouldn't be pushing that hard in the first set of four. I mean, it should be hard because you should be running pretty darn fast if you're doing 800 repeats. But if it's so hard that you don't feel in control in the first four of eight, you're probably not going to be able to finish that workout strong. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing I think a lot of people probably are willing, and I struggle with this too. I think a lot of people are probably willing to work harder in workouts than they are races because they get to races and they get scared and they give up, you know, and it's so mental. Like you've got to get your head in the game to not give up.
So you ran recently. Did Glenn pace you for the half that you just ran? He did, right? He ran that with you?
Yeah. So he, I told him, this is the year of Lindsay. You can run whatever, but like, this is the year that I'm racing. And so my races take priority because I've had three babies and one major surgery and one major injury in the past 5 years. So like, this is my year.
Good for you. I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And he's all about it. But I mean, that being said, he's still running 70 miles a week because he's insane. But he's not doing like workouts or anything like that. He's just running because he seriously, Glenn of all people, he is someone that I really look up to as a runner. And I think a lot of people could and should if they knew him because he truly just loves to run. Ugh, he really does.
Glenn's the best.
Yeah. Like he wakes up in the morning and he wants to go run. He's not like, oh, I have to run today. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people want to get their run in early in the morning so that they don't have to think about it all day. Like he literally doesn't care. He just likes to run. So he doesn't matter when he does it. And he usually does it at 5 a.m. because that's the available time slot in our life. But, he gives the best advice because what he always tells me is, don't think, just run. You know, like if you have a hard workout and you're dwelling on that all day long, like what is the point of that? Don't think about it. Just run hard. Just go work hard, you know? And that makes it so much more simple.
Yeah, he's right. So when he paced you, did you have a watch on as well? Or were you totally just sticking with him?
So I did not wear a watch and on purpose. So he's paced me for 2 half marathons recently. So I say he paced me, but really he runs with me. He wears a watch, but we don't talk about the pace or anything like that. And this recent half marathon, I kind of set the pace and he just ran with me the whole time. And I knew, so I ended up running like a 132, 30 something. And I kind of knew 7-minute miles were what I was probably capable of based on some tempo runs that I had recently done. And I gave myself a really nice taper. Like normally I wouldn't really taper up so much for a half marathon because I would usually be marathon training, but I was like, Lindsay, rest your legs really good so you can really see what you can do for this race. And so I kind of knew around 7 minutes was probably what I was capable of. Any less would probably be a stretch. So I went out about that pace and we got to the track, which was mile 6. And he was kind of like, you're kind of getting ahead of yourself a little bit. And then around mile 7, he said it again. He goes, you're doing that thing again. And it was fun too, because he did the Women's Running Magazine takeover that day. So he was taking video of the whole race. And so it was fun for me. And I saved that video because I think it'll be fun to look back on. But I remember being annoyed with him though, because I was ticking away at a very comfortable cadence, like our dog. And I was afraid if I slowed up that it would kind of get me out of my rhythm. So I was hanging on pretty hard the last 5K. I mean, I was pretty excited to see my splits because I didn't drop slower than I think my slowest mile was like 7:09. So that I was like, that's pretty darn consistent because my first mile was 7:07.
Wow.
But I dropped some like 6:50s there in the middle, which made my time faster. But that's when Glenn was saying he was looking at his watch. I had no idea what I was running. I just knew it was around 7 minutes, give or take 10 seconds. And that's when he was like, he knew that for me running 6:50 pace for the next 6 miles was probably not doable. And it wasn't. I didn't do it.
That's awesome, though. I love that you're able to run together. And I'm very envious of that. Brian is not so keen on being my running buddy. So
it is pretty amazing. And it's what's really fun. When we first started running together, I was faster than Glenn. And I think I generally, like, if you stacked up me with females and him with males, I generally will place higher than him, you know, in my division or whatever. But he just got in his head back in the day. He was like, I'm going to break 3 hours in the marathon. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And he just went and did it. And now his marathon PR is 2:49.
That's awesome.
Which is an hour faster than what he first ran. And he was anemic and a little bit there for a while. But my whole point is, it's so fun to have a husband that's way faster than you, because he can, like, kick my ass in workouts and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I love that. That's when Brian and I are on the bike. That's the way that we are. He's so much, like, his easy day is a tempo on the bike for me. But you and Glenn, you are both also running coaches.
This is true. Although I coach way more people than he does.
Oh,
like,
see,
step your game up, dude. Step your game up.
Imagine if Glenn coached me. I think I would love it. And I think he would be like, get this girl out of my face.
It takes a special person for Glenn to coach, because Glenn's like, no BS.
Yeah. And I'm all BS.
I can fluff it up a little bit more. And sometimes, you know, we bounce ideas off of each other and whatnot. And he's a little more get your shit done kind of coach.
Yeah. What is your favorite type of athlete to coach?
Oh, definitely somebody who's trying to BQ. Like, I think that's so fun. Yeah. I mean, and I think it's very much, I mean, I like coaching beginning runners too. Don't get me wrong, but I just think that's really, really up my alley. I have a passion for that, and that pace and those workouts specific to those times are really, I think I'm good at it. And I think I'm a good cheerleader for that type of runner as well.
Have you ever had a runner come to you and say, like, hey, here are the times I'm running right now. I want you to coach me to a BQ. And you've said, like, I don't think that's possible yet.
Well, yeah, a lot of times what we'll do, so we send people like an athlete questionnaire. And so we assess, you know, it has a million questions on it, and what their PRs are and how long they've been running and how many miles a week they're currently running and how many hours a week they work and, you know, all kinds of factors that go into what training looks like and where they've been coming from and what they're doing now. And yeah, I mean, if someone comes to me and their marathon PR is, say, 4 hours and 15 minutes or something like that, and they want to BQ, usually I say, okay, well, we need to do like a 22-week cycle or something like that that's pretty lengthy, and start out the first 4 weeks and then, like, kind of start assessing where this is going and what paces we're hitting for workouts. And more likely than not, it's probably going to take you a couple seasons to, mm-hmm. to get there. Not necessarily. I mean, some people can take off huge chunks if they just weren't doing any speed work or, you know, we're only running 25 miles a week or something like that. And I've had people that come and it does take a few cycles and then they do it and it's awesome.
As an expert, as a running expert and coach, what is the most common mistake you see runners making?
People run their easy runs way too fast. I mean, way too fast. It's insane. Don't tell me that you want to run a 3:30 marathon and your easy pace is 8:15 or 8:30 pace. No, no, no. Your easy pace is not 15 to 30 seconds slower than what your goal marathon time is. And that is so hard for people to wrap their head around, because they mm-hmm. think, if I want to run 8 minute miles for 26 miles, that better be really easy for me to do for 8 miles or 10 miles or, you know, on all my easy runs. No, false. I mean, when I'm doing a marathon paced workout, like, I'm working hard, and there's a reason you taper, and there's a reason that your body is rested and ready to go, and you've had 20 weeks or whatever of built up training on race day. Your marathon paced miles, those are hard miles to run. So your easy paced miles should be at least, I'd say, a minute slower than what you're trying to run a full marathon in.
Let's move on. Let's get to the sprint to the finish round. Are you ready, Lindsay?
Okay, go ahead.
What would your last meal on earth be?
Probably, this is so boring, but probably just like pizza or really good Mexican food with chips and salsa and guacamole.
Ooh, yum. What is your favorite movie?
Something funny, like Bridesmaids. I mean, that's not the best movie out there, but I generally like a comedy.
Greatest fear?
Dying before my kids grow up.
Ooh.
I know, sad,
ooh,
right?
Lindsay. Jeez.
I know.
Okay, what is your favorite race you've ever done?
Oh, well, this is super simple, but probably the Monumental Mile. We just did it last week, and it's so fun. It's 1 mile, and it ramps up, gets you ramped up for the fall marathon season. It's the race, the marathon that I'm running this fall puts it on, so it's kind of like a way to kick off the season. And it's 1 mile, and you start on 12th Street, in downtown Indianapolis on like the main drag, and you go straight down to the circle. And, you know, like women have their own division, men, and then there's masters, and then the elite race is last. So, and then there's like food trucks and a band playing. It's so fun. So we got a babysitter and raced a mile and then went to dinner last week, and it was so much fun.
Do you have a go-to mantra for races or tough workouts?
Even if I'm on the treadmill and there are people beside me, I'm always like, I just say go, like go, like Lindsay, you can do this. And I'm like sitting there saying go. But you know, recently, and I think I've matured a lot and changed a lot in my running in the past couple years and going through these pregnancies and stuff. One thing that Glenn really helps me with and instills in me is like, have fun. I mean, he always says to me, and he was saying this to me in the mini when I was kind of like really working hard in that last 5K, enjoy the hard work. It's hard and it hurts, but enjoy that you're here doing it, and smile, because if you smile, even though it hurts really bad, that kind of like lightens up the mood a little bit. And let's be honest, I'm not like running in the Olympics here.
But you could if you set your mind to it. I believe in you.
Oh, gosh. I would never want to do that. Try to do that.
No, sounds like a lot of pressure, honestly. Representing a whole country? No, thank you. What is the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?
Go downstairs and get my, warm up my water for my hot lemon water.
Your lemon water.
Glenn calls it my prison water.
Grim. What is the last thing you do before you close your eyes at night?
I always have my Kindle in bed, and though I do, I am just as guilty as probably 90% of the people listening. I do sit on my phone and look at Instagram and Twitter and check my email like one last time before bed, but I always try to finish with my Kindle, and I usually get through, like, at least at this point in my life, I get through like 4 pages of pretty big font before I start falling asleep. And I do take melatonin every single night, so that has something to do with it.
Saturday long run or Sunday long run?
Normally I would say Saturday, but this training cycle, I'm kind of doing things a little bit different, and I'm kind of all over the place and doing a longer cycle between my long runs. So I have the luxury of being able to do a long run on like a Thursday. So I'll probably be all over the place there this cycle.
Yeah.
But if I had to choose, I would say Saturday.
Who was your childhood celebrity crush?
I don't know how young I was, but I loved Freddie Prinze Jr.
Oh, yeah. And isn't he married to Sarah Michelle Gellar? Aren't they still together?
Yeah, for like a really long time.
Oh, good for them. Good for them.
Applauding you. And I think they have a few kids, and they're not really either of them. They're not in the spotlight.
I love that.
Maybe they made enough money and they're like, we can just live like normal people now. Or maybe they...
Or they have jobs. Like, for all we know, Freddie Prinze Jr., he might be on the toast at the Village Deli. We don't know.
He was... he might be making like $8 an hour on the toast. No, I feel like a lot of people answer like Jonathan Taylor Thomas or something like that. He was that. Yeah, he was my guy. Or... I was really into NSYNC when I was, you know, in high school. So
nice. Who was your guy from NSYNC?
Well, it's funny because looking back, like, you know, it has to be JT, right? But I think I was trying to be different and said that I liked JC.
JC, yeah. I think I liked, I liked Brian Luttrell from the Backstreet Boys.
Oh, yeah, totally. For sure. But they weren't, were you more Backstreet than NSYNC?
You know, I liked NSYNC because they were cooler, but I actually liked Backstreet Boys' music better.
We've talked about this before.
Yeah, have we?
I think you're right. I do think you're right. But yeah, NSYNC's cooler. But yeah, if you really look at their music, if you look at their albums, Backstreet Boys probably has better music.
Speaking of music, what do you listen to when you run?
I listen to podcasts, but I also listen to a lot of Tupac, a lot of Eminem. Sometimes I listen to like Pearl Jam. I don't know why, because of Glenn, I guess he has that in my head, but a lot of like Flo Rida. I like the gangster rap.
All right. So now we get to the actual last question on the show, which you knew it was coming.
Yes.
Lindsay, you're hosting a dinner party. You get to have 5 guests. Who would you like to have?
These people are only if I already know them. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked a couple famous people, but I don't want it to be like famous people we've never met. Hi. I mean, this is like if I was already friends with them. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So Kristen Wiig.
Ooh.
Tina Fey. And that's like, they're not celebrities. They're my friends. And then I have a couple other women, Vivian Maley, which nobody will know, and Deb Gardner, which nobody will know. But they are two women that live here in Indianapolis who they're probably like 20 years older than me that I just kind of look up to them in life in general. And Glenn and I keep saying we're going to have both of them with their husbands over for dinner sometime anyway. So I'm like, they are perfect. Like, I look at them as kind of like a mothering type mentor. And then my fifth person, people are going to think I'm just way too obsessed with my husband because I've talked about him so much in this episode. I swear it's not like that. But I picked Eddie Vedder because I've been to like 5 Pearl Jam concerts, and I just know way too much about the band than a normal person. And I think it would get me inside Glenn's head a little bit more because it's so obsessed with this band. But that's random, and I don't know if they would all be together at the table. I've really thought about this a lot, Allie.
I appreciate that. And I feel like we could make this dinner party happen for you. You already know 2 of the people. It's only a matter of time before, you know, you meet Eddie Vedder.
I would die if Kristen Wiig came on my podcast, and first of all.
She would do it.
Well, and the other thing when I thought about this list was I was sitting at the pool. I went for a swim, and then I sat at the pool, and I hung out for like 45 minutes with no kids around me. It was amazing. And I was like, who makes you like belly laugh? Like, I wanted, who would make me laugh? That's who I want to have my dinner party with. And the 2 ladies, they would give me wisdom, and the other 2 would make me belly laugh. So that was what was important to me. And then Eddie could sing a song. So
yeah, you've got all the bases covered. That sounds like a great party. And Lindsay, thank you so much for coming and being on the show. I always love getting to talk with you, and I'm sure we will probably do this many more times, or I hope we'll do this many more times.
I want to. Like, I don't want it to be over. I'm so sad.
I know. I'm sad. We're going to hang up, but then I'm going to call you on video Skype to say thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Yay! Thank you so much to Lindsay for letting me ask the questions this time around and for being so open, honest, and fun. I swear time flies when I talk with this woman. We've recorded 3 podcast episodes together now. First on her show in November, then on a bonus episode for I'll Have Another Patreon supporters, which I have linked to in the show notes, and then we recorded this episode. And every time Lindsay and I chat, it's for at least 2 hours. So YOLO, mom, that means you only live once, and it's my favorite phrase, and I'm thinking about getting it tattooed across my chest. Don't be mad. As always, thank you so much for listening to the Allie on the Run show. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to seeing you back here next Tuesday and Thursday for more good stuff. If you loved it, make sure you subscribe to the Allie on the Run show on iTunes and consider leaving a rating and review for the show. It's very easy. To leave a rating, just click the stars. To leave a review, just go ahead and write a few sentences on iTunes, and be sure to hit me up with feedback. I'm Allie on the Run 1 on Instagram and Twitter, and I'm always rocking and rolling over at the Allie on the Run Facebook page, which is new, and I'd love it if you'd like it. With that, have a beautiful day, and thank you so much for joining me on the run.